questions that I have here. Number one, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam rose to establish justice, right? That's understandable because it was his responsibility as divine leader, right? To establish justice. And the question, however, I have is that he set off, he got killed. What justice was established? What rights did he gain for anyone, anywhere? I mean, even after
can I
that,
you a question and you
the Ahl al-Bayt were under even more pressure.
Medina was attacked by Yazid.
Exactly,
after the death
and the
of
Kaaba
Imam
was burned down.
The Kaaba was burned down. People still, they're saying that's available. وَارْتَدَّ النَّاسِ عَنِ الدِّينِ إِلَّا ثَلَاثَ بَعْدَ مَقْتَلِ الْحُسَيْنِ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ. And then they state the three companions of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam. So where was the justice?
By killing a person and thinking that you have put up everything and you have actually closed it down and nothing comes up. So it's a quite, I mean, wrong understanding of the reality.
Are you saying that it had long-term
effects? So this blood, actually, this is the blood that is flourishing, that it comes up and actually this gives life to the Islamic Ummah.
Through generations.
Yeah. What is Yazid now and what is Hussein? What is the status of Yazid in the in Islamic Ummah? So, let me tell you some, let's say, some quotes from Islamic scholars about Yazid.
Before that, can I just bring up this quote of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam that pretty much answers your question? Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, when he entered Medina after Karbala, people were sending their condolences and telling him, Adham Allah Ajrak, and they were praying for him, you know, trying to
console him.
Yeah, console him and whatnot. A man came who was happy with what happened to Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, who said, who won? He asked him, who won? Imam Sajjad alayhi salam replied, when the adhan comes up, you will know who won. This is a very deep statement. And of course, I don't say it's the reason of Munvit of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, but I say that it's one of the benefits that happened because of the killing of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that the religion remained, that Yazid has no power to do with Muawiyah what Muawiyah did, that propaganda that Muawiyah had, which was pretty much to wear the dress of Islam and state that we are Islam, we are the representative of Islam. Yazid has no power to do that anymore because of the movement of Imam Hussein.
By killing Imam al-Hussein, Yazid dug his own grave.
Yeah, look, Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani, in his book Al-Sawa'iq, he narrates from Imam Ahmad Hanbal, that is the leader of the Hanbalis.
Yes.
That when he was asked, are we allowed to curse Yazid? I said, whom should we curse if we do not curse Yazid? Imam of Hanabala, right? Allama Taftazani Hanafi. Again, in his book, Sharh al-Aqa'id.
Sharh al-Maqasid or Sharh al-Aqa'id?
Sharh al-Aqa'id. He says that, again, when Yazid killed the family and the household of the Prophet and actually insulted them, and it is frequently narrated what about the news and the akhbar that happened there, and we all agree about his disbelief,
his kufr,
his blatant blasphemy.
Let me not talk about Imam Shawkani. Let me not say what, let's say, Ibn Khaldun said. Let me not tell you what Ibn Jawzi al-Hanbali said. So this is the Yazid in today's life. And Hussein.
So just long-term effects. We're talking about long-term
effects.
No, even
in the short term. Even in the short term, right. Look, those who missed the time and did not accompany Hussein and stood in front of him, exactly a minute after his martyrdom, started their grief and their sorrow.
The people of Kufa when the...
Not only
from Shias of Iraq, different groups of Islamic Ummah at that time. Right after the martyrdom of Hussein, they understood what a big mistake they did.
Inside of Sham, when Imam Zain al-Abidin,
that's why one of the lessons that we take from the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, we have to understand what time we are in. We have to learn about the moments. Look, these moments are very critical. Sometimes it's very short and we have to make a big decision. So this is the lesson that we have to take. Where are we now standing? Are we with Hussein of the time or in front of Hussein of the time? So this is what we have to learn.
There are a couple of things that can I add, please? I want to just add two things. My brother beautifully put it out there that if we believe that the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam was a revolt, a revolution, to bring up justice, And
but you don't believe that, though. You don't like calling it
That the concept of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the basis of the takfiris is not the same as the base of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The true divine bases that are available. Yani even the Shias, when they come to talk about the factor of rising, all of them agree that there has to be the idhn, the permission of the Imam or Na'ibi, the authority after the Imam. And anyhow, there's also a different answer to what the brother stated that's also available out there. And I always like to introduce it. It's very important for me, I feel, that the fact that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who said that he was revolting? And
you really, always press on that.
Yes. And the fact is that the only thing that Imam Hussein alayhi salam did was not do bay'ah to Yazid. Abdullah ibn Zubayr also didn't do bay'ah to Yazid.
Yes, dear Sheikh, look, this is true. I agree with you, but look, just a moment, yes. In parenthesis. Look, this may have shown a disagreement by revolt, by uprising, by whatever you want to call it.
It was a rebellion.
No, there's this thing in the middle. There's this gray area.
We are not fighting on the terms and the words.
There's this gray area of staying quiet. The thing that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam did. The thing that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam did. The thing that Imam al-Askar alayhi salam did. This is staying quiet. I'm not against you. I'm not with you. I'm not doing anything. Just leave me alone. This concept of just leave me alone. So there are three choices that the Imam alayhi salam had. Fight against him, agree with him, or sit down. Fight against him, you need an army. The people of Kufa, Imam Hussein, it's a long topic, I know, but in summary, simple people knew that Kufa was against, were betrayers. From the time of Amir Mu'minin to Imam Hassan. So how about Imam Hussein with his wisdom? Even if we take them like an ordinary smart person. There's this, I don't have the right army. I don't have the right people. Or at least when I registered to Kufa, before Kufa, there was no chance of going back. The way that he, and agreeing with Yazid is against Islam. Because if I agree with Yazid now, Islam would demolish. So there's this concept of staying quiet, like how Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam did with the bay'ah of As-Saqifah. And وَكَانَ اللَّهُ يُحِبُّ الْمُحْسَنِينَ It would have went through. But Yazid, no, wanted the head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He wanted to kill him. Send me with this message, this reply to Walid ibn Aqma, with this message, the head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein exited Medina. When he exited Medina, he went to Mecca, the safest place on earth. In the safest place of earth, Yazid sent Al-Asraj, who was put in place of Walid ibn Aqba, to Mecca to kill Imam Hussein alayhi salam, to assassinate him, even if he was متعلق بأستار الكعبة. So he left Mecca.
What does that mean?
If he was attached to the Kaaba. He was seeking refuge to the Kaaba. Even if he was in that status, they wanted to kill him. So he left because he was afraid, he was going to get killed. And he doesn't want to get killed. Look at his words. He says, "An uqtul shubran an Mecca." To be killed, one shubr. What is shubr?
A few inches away.
A few inches off Mecca is better than to be killed in Mecca. "Inni akhaf an akun al-kabsha alladhi qala anhu Rasulullah." Rasulullah was talking about Abdullah ibn Zubayr. "I am afraid to be the cattle that would be slaughtered inside of Mecca." And therefore, when he went to Kufa, it was the safe place for him. Basra, people were against him because of the war of Basra. They were against his house. He wanted to go to Yemen. It was far off. The best place to go was Kufa. Why? Because people were calling that we will defend you. We will help you. We are calling for you. We are against Yazid. So it was a place to be, to defend at least.
And then?
And then the betrayal happened with Muslim Naqil. He rushed to Wadi al-Aqiq, if I'm not wrong, or al-Tan'im. I forgot the place. The army of Hur came. They wanted to take him as a prisoner. He told them, "Let me go.
Let me go back.
Let me go back. Let me go Yemen. Let me go Hind." They said, "No. You will come under the government of..."
So basically, Imam al-Hussein was minding his own business.
Yes.
Yazid kept pushing and pushing and pushing.
Yes.
Yazid was either, he was like, either pledge your allegiance to me or I'm going to kill you.
Yes.
And Imam al-Hussein tried to avoid it and avoid it and avoid it. And he was like, "Let me go to Kufa. They're calling for me." He went. They stopped him anyway. And they were still like, "We're going to kill you.
Yeah, and then they took him to Karbala.
Where do you want to go?
And then he reaches Karbala. Again, another thing to also keep in mind, to consider. The Imam alayhi salam, when they say cry, does this crying have a mawdu'iyah, that it's by itself a subject or that is recommended? Or like how, for example, Sayyid Musa al-Sadr states that Imam Hussein alayhi salam or the Ahl Bayt do not care about the crying part. The crying part is a path for you to do this and that and this and that and to wake up and to understand. And they call it the teachings of Karbala. There's a big difference between the two.
The respected Sheikh, Brother Habib, says that Imam Hussein alayhi salam did not make an uprising or a revolution, whatever we can call it, what we mean by the word inqilab. I want to say no, it was really an uprising against the tyrant regime of the time. So there are lots of evidences that helps us to see what was the goal and the objective of Imam from this movement. Let's study Imam from the very beginning. Imam, what does he say in his words? He says that I have left to make reforms in the Ummah of the Holy Prophet, in the nation of my grandfather, the Holy Prophet, and to do Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahi al Munkar, to actually ask people to perform, to enjoy the good and refrain from the evil. So let's talk about these two phrases that Imam alayhi salam himself said. So to follow exactly what happened at that time, which was against the nation, against the sunnah of the Holy Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So it means that there was a great distortion. Second, Moses Amrun bin Ma'ruf, enjoining the good. As for Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar, it is quite famous that they have three stages. The first stage of Amr bin Ma'ruf, that is enjoining the good, is the stage of doing it by heart. Second stage is to perform and do it by tongue. The third stage is the practical level of Amr bin Ma'ruf. The same goes for Amr Nahi Anil Munkar. So what is the greatest Amr in an Islamic Ummah? Establishment or Iqamah, whatever we have titled it, whatever we have named it as, Iqamah of Hukumatul Adl. What has been defined as the mission of all the prophets, all the divine prophets of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and the scene of the earth. So all of them have come, based on what Allah says in Quran, to establish iqamah, or to do and to create a just government. So this is the highest level of amr, the practical way of it. So Imam, as the leader of the Islamic Ummah, has had to do something for that. Again, let's see the opposite side. What is the highest level of munkar? The highest level of munkar, the evil, as the tyrant government, the distorted government of the time. So it's the duty of Imam and the leaders of the Islamic Ummah, or even the followers, to perform all those three stages. So Imam, even at the time of Muawiyah, he showed his hatred of the governing system of Muawiyah by sending him some letters. You might say that, okay, why Imam was silent at that time? No, Imam was not even silent at that time. He sent the letters. He warned him with the mistakes that he had in his rulership and government. He told him this. These points are the points that you have deviated from the true and genuine Muhammadan Islam. And again, he showed his hatred. Second, he wrote a letter. But what happened to the functional action, to functional level of it? So it was due to the duty of Imam, because Imam is not a person who breaks the treaties. Imam, through the treaties that actually was written and signed between Muawiyah and Imam Hassan alayhi salam, he was still under the treaty. So he could not actually emerge and get out of that treaty. So you might say, okay, Muawiyah before that, somewhere in the masjid, said, okay, I'm not following this treaty anymore. Yes, but Muawiyah used politics to say that. He came and said that, he in the masjid, he said that, okay, there are some other commitments which are not in this treaty, and I'm leaving those treaties. I'm leaving them out. So it means that politically he was going to actually fool people that, okay, this is, I'm not directly actually breaking the treaty. So it was, in case Imam wanted to break the treaty, he was known as the person who actually broke the promise that was given earlier. So Imam did everything. I mean, Imam did all the levels and stages of Amr bin Ma'ruf. When it comes to the Nahi Anil Munkar, so the highest level of Munkar, as I said, is the government of deviation, the government of distortion, the government of Yazid. That Imam said, a person like me is never ever allowed to actually pay allegiance with a person like Yazid. Everyone knew who Yazid was at that time. So Imam actually wanted to do so. At this time, he's not under any treaty anymore. So he leaves Medina, he goes towards Mecca. Because Yazid sent Walid ibn Utbah to take allegiance from Imam alayhi salam in Medina, But Imam left Medina in order to not respond him, not to reply him, and leaves for a city that he can find a media for himself. Yes, in Mecca there is a place that Hajjaj and the Hajjis come every year. And at that time, at that place, I could even send the message of Islam and the message of true Muhammad and Islam to the Hajjaj from different nations. Again, Yazid sent a group, a troop to kill Imam in Mecca. So what was Imam's actually innovation here? Imam doesn't want the land of security, Madinatul Amn of Mecca, to be changed into a Medina of actually shedding the blood of the people. So what does Imam do? Imam says that I don't want my blood to be covered in the land of Mecca. He looks for another way. At this time, we have seen that letters are flooding from Kufa, that Muslims from Kufa invite him to come and actually take the leadership. Okay, Imam, as the leader of the Islamic Ummah, what is his duty? Is to answer the letters, to reply to the letters. When it is the duty of him, even though he knew what would be the outcome and consequence of that, Imam replies to the letter and he sends Muslim ibn Aqil to Kufa. Okay, then what happens? The brother said that, okay, even Imam in the middle of the way said, okay, you are not going to accept me anymore, I'll go back. No, brother, it's not true. Imam, even at the middle, at the beginning of the way, he understood that Muslim was got martyred. So in case at that time, even Imam could leave, could go back to another city or to Medina or to anywhere else. No, Imam knew purposely. Imam knew that he had started a reform movement, what we call it, a revolution, an uprising against the tyrant ruler of the time. So he continues to go. Yes. When Imam says such a thing, based on what the brother says, it's due to the duty of a Muslim and a leader of the Ummah that he never starts a war, what we call it, primitive war, or Jihad al-Ibtida'i. So Imam does not, like the Holy Prophet, does not want to start any war. But at the time that defense becomes compulsory, no, Imam is not someone who leaves the battlefield. He stands in the battlefield till he is martyred. So this is the philosophy behind the story of Ashura and Karbala.
This will also open the doors for you to make assumptions about Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, especially those who claim, like Sayyid al-Khuwan.
I'm so very glad.
From his explanation, I can make it also a good conclusion that even while the Maja in Iraq says that, okay, stay at home and then do not
that's why
make chaos,
that
this is very good to know that religion and states are interrelated.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Religion and states,
yes,
I mean, Dina Siyasa, they are not disrelated.
We had Madina al-Hub, now we're saying Madina al-Siyasa.
This is a really rational point that we are, I mean, after 40 years in Islamic Republic, we are saying and want to tell the Islamic Ummah, religion is intermingled with the states. And
it
we
is.
Have to know
it
that
is.
The Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, at the same time that he was an Islamic leader, at the same time he was a political leader of the Medina. And he was the leader,
yes.
And let's say, whatever we can call it, in Medina. He was the person who made this city-state in Arabian Peninsula.
When you look at the Islamic laws, there cannot be religion with a state without religion.
Very true.
Al-Hudud, the capital punishments, the diyas, al-Hakim al-Shar'i, Baytul Mal, if we accept
inheritance.
That there's this inheritance. Not only that, Imam Salat al-Jum'ah, al-Qadi,
the
judges.
Right.
All of these have to do with religion, path of life. Religion
is
inseparable from state.
I'm very
states.
Glad that we opened this door because finally Brother Habib got to defend his stance. And we all came to this conclusion that we were saying the same thing from the very beginning. We always
There's
do
that.
There's
a difference to it. There's a difference
but
to
there
it.
Are key points that everyone stresses on when in expressing their opinions. And I like that. I respect that too because it brings us to such a deeper understanding of Ashura, and that's the point of such discussions. Inshallah ta'ala, if there are any other points that you guys want to continue, we can pick it up in further episodes of this show. Thank you so very much for being with us. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Allahumma ja'al mahya ya mahya Muhammad wa al Muhammad ومماتي ممات محمد وآل محمد
Hussein, you live forever in our hearts and in our minds.
Hussein, you live
swear to Allah, you have shown us so much courage through the pain. You sacrificed your family and were killed thirsty for Hussein.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Yemen is facing a fuel crisis as Saudi Arabia and its allies continue to block fuel ships in violation of a UN brokered truce and steal the country's crude oil. Yemen's Ministry of Oil has held a press conference in Sana'a to discuss the issue.
There are 13 oil basins in Yemen, of which only two are invested, namely Safar and Al Masila, at a rate of only 18%. These basins are located in Marib and Shabwa, and they are controlled by the Saudi-backed forces. They are continuously being looted, and this reflects negatively on the Yemeni economy. The systematic looting is one of the reasons for the years-long war against us by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The ministry says the plundered oil is worth billions of dollars, which is enough to pay the suspended salaries of Yemeni employees. It held the Saudi-led coalition responsible for cutting off the salaries as the oil sales are being supplied to Saudi banks.
What the Saudi-led coalition is doing is the systematic looting of Yemeni oil and gas. The total amount that was looted from 2018 until July 2022 is about 130 million barrels, with a total value of about $9.5 billion. This money is enough to pay the Yemeni suspended salaries for 5 years. Unfortunately, they give the money from the plundered oil to the National Bank of Saudi Arabia and not to the Central Bank of Yemen.
Yemen's petroleum company warned of an imminent fuel crisis as Riyadh is still preventing 9 fuel ships from entering the country, which is a clear violation of the UN brokered truce. However, the world body remains silent toward the Saudi violations.
As Yemenis face a fuel crunch due to the Saudi blockade, they are urging the United Nations to force Riyadh to fulfill its commitments under the ceasefire agreement and to stop detaining fuel ships headed to the country. They say pillaging Yemeni oil also reveals why the Saudi-led coalition launched a war on their country. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Did the UK authorities cover up the trafficking of 3 British schoolgirls who joined the notorious Daesh terror group back in 2015? That is the question now being asked following shock allegations revealed in a new book, which claims that Canadian intelligence officers informed British police that the girls had entered Syria with the help of a double agent, Mohammed al-Rashid, who provided information to Canada on who he had smuggled to ISIL. One of the girls involved is the former UK citizen Shamima Begum, who is currently fighting for a return to Britain under the argument she was groomed by traffickers.
An inquiry has been demanded after it emerged that Canada knew about the teenager's fate but kept silent while the Metropolitan Police ran a frantic international search for the trio. The book has claimed that Canada privately admitted its involvement only when it feared being exposed and successfully asked British authorities to cover up its role. The scandal has now reopened the debate over stripping Begum of her nationality.
Following the latest allegations, we spoke with the Begum family lawyer for his reaction.
Now, the reason that was rather egregious for us was because we had asked specifically the Met Police at the end of March 2015 about updates regarding anything that could be coming of use from al-Rashid, and they confirmed that they had no updates, and that clearly is not the case if what Richard Walton is saying is actually true in this book. This revelation about a Canadian security services asset being one fundamental element that allowed these girls to cross over, well, that speaks against error. It speaks more to a concerted, securitized effort to have these goals go across. And that's actually true of the Canadians. The question remains of whether other security agencies who were working with these girls, with these handlers of this Canadian asset, who wanted the same thing. And that's a question, and that's why an inquiry is very important.
A spokesman for the UK government said they do not comment on operational intelligence or security matters. But choosing to remain silent won't be enough to quell the growing questions surrounding the way Western intelligence dealt with Daesh or their sophisticated smuggling operations, which saw so many Westerners slip through the net, including the young and vulnerable. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's Kish airline is back to Afghanistan. Afghan and Iranian officials have welcomed this in a ceremony at Kabul's International Airport and stressed the importance of closer economic cooperation between the two countries.
We're happy today and welcome Turkish Airlines. We have very good relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran and do our best to expand cooperation in the political, economic and social fields.
This airway can be very helpful in the economic and cultural fields. I think such flights will soon be welcomed by other airlines as well, and that makes transportation between the two countries easier.
Iran has always tried to help boost Afghanistan's economy, and the resumption of Kish Air flights to Afghanistan can be considered another positive step in that regard.
Considering the changes that have taken place in Afghanistan since last year, the number of people coming from Afghanistan to Iran has risen, and that demand should be met. This is not enough, and we need to do more, and such activities are very effective in boosting economic relations between the two countries.
In recent months, Afghanistan has been deprived of many sources of international aid and even its own financial assets held in the United States. Now, Afghanistan's cooperation with Iran appears to be vital to the country's economic growth.
Such economic activities in cooperation with other neighboring countries promise the improvement of Afghanistan's economy by providing job and investment opportunities for people and for businessmen. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
On Thursday, Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine.
Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, 3 times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
if energy costs keep rising at the current pace. Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
The China Global Television Network and Chinese Public Opinion Institute have conducted a survey in Afghanistan and 24 global countries to assess the 20-year American war on Afghanistan.
Now, the Taliban will pay a price.
At the beginning of its presence in Afghanistan, the U.S. made a commitment to build a stable, strong, and prosperous Afghanistan, claiming it would establish democracy, fight against terrorism, and rebuild the nation. Nearly 79% of the Afghan respondents polled said the U.S. did not keep its promise, while 80% termed the U.S. war in their country a complete failure.
The U.S. never abided by its promises. Current disasters in Afghanistan have all resulted from the U.S. failures. We would witness better days today if the U.S. hadn't occupied our country. 20 years ago, the Taliban were ruling Afghanistan, and today they have control again. So what did the years of U.S. war and huge expenses change in our country? The U.S. claimed to bring prosperity in Afghanistan. Instead, it destroyed everything.
During the war, Afghanistan faced severe challenges with regards to security, economy, and people's livelihoods. Some 56.6% of Afghan respondents said the U.S. left the Afghan economy worse than it was in 2001. Yet 80% of global respondents believe that the causes of local terrorism still exist in the war-ravaged country.
I've been in Afghanistan through the U.S. invasion. I agree with the results of the poll. The U.S. came to our country claiming to counter terrorism and help the Afghan economy grow, but practically none of them materialized. The U.S. institutionalized fraud and abuse. As a result, today Afghans don't have food to eat and terrorism threats are rising.
Meanwhile, 68% of the respondents said the U.S. war in Afghanistan has caused the U.S. to continue to lose its credibility with the international community. Some 65% of those surveyed in Afghanistan said they believe neighboring countries, including Iran, Pakistan, and China, play a key role in the rebuilding of the war-battered nation. 70% of global respondents described Washington seizing Afghanistan's assets as pure looting. They called on the U.S. to return Afghans' money. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
On the 44th anniversary of the disappearance of Imam Musa Sadr, Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Biri stressed that the kidnapping of the prominent Shiite cleric was a crime that is a sovereign Lebanese case.
The failure of the current Libyan authorities to cooperate with the Lebanese authorities is considered to be collusion. The Arab League must press the authorities to cooperate.
Commenting on the issue of the demarcation of the country's southern maritime border with the Israeli occupying regime, the House Speaker accused the U.S. envoy of buying time.
We will not concede our rights, nor will we concede our sovereignty, and we will defend our land, sea, and resources with all our might. The ball now is in the court of the U.S. The U.S. envoy Hochstein said that he will be absent for 2 weeks, but 1 month has passed and we have not received an answer.
People from all over the country came to the southern town of Tyre to commemorate the man who was seen as a hope for the oppressed and a reason to stop internal strife.
I don't have much to say except that I'm touched by all this love for Imam Sadr. May God uncover his fate.
Imam Sadr resembles the light, the beam of light that at a certain time, in the midst of darkness, came to Lebanon and led Lebanon and the Lebanese to a new life of accepting the other, of cherishing the other, life of victory.
You see, you can have tears when you see all these people are coming, just because that person is a very exceptional. He came as a blessing from the sky, I would consider, in the middle amongst of all, when Lebanon was suffering and still suffering.
The only verified fact concerning Imam Sadr's case was that he arrived in the Libyan capital of Tripoli at the end of August 1978 with two companions, Sheikh Muhammad Yaqub and journalist Abbas Badreddin. Back then, the regime of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi had claimed that the three men boarded a flight to Italy on August 31st. But al-Sadr and his companions were never seen again.
Many had hoped that the fall of former dictator Muammar Gaddafi would reveal the secrets about the disappearance of Sayyid Musa Sadr. But those secrets were buried with the Libyan dictator, which led to a dead-end investigation. Maryam Saleh from Tyre, South Lebanon.
The Iranian Foreign Minister's short notice visit to Russia carries major messages, as it comes at a time when Tehran is carefully examining the recent U.S. draft response to the 2015 deal, which holds Russia as one of its signatories. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was warmly greeted in Moscow on Wednesday by his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. The Russian foreign minister once again reaffirmed his country's support for a fair deal or no deal.
The Russian Federation shares the same stances as Iran towards the 2015 deal. We believe that the U.S.'s illegal sanctions against Iran must be removed to save the deal.
Meanwhile, Tehran and Washington are currently exchanging comments on the European Union's new draft proposal for the revival of what is known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran has repeatedly said it wants a sustainable accord, which includes guarantees that would make the deal immune to any possible withdrawal by the U.S. administration.
My colleagues are thoroughly reviewing the American text. We seek stronger and more reliable guarantees from the U.S. to prevent any future withdrawal from the deal by the U.S. government.
The 2015 deal was cast into limbo in 2018 when Washington unilaterally walked out of the accord and reinstated sanctions on Tehran. Iran, in return, scaled back some of its commitments to the pact, saying it will return to its obligations only after the U.S. removes all anti-Iran sanctions. The Vienna talks over the revival of the accord have faced a hiatus over the past 5 months. The discussions are now set to resume after Iran approves and accepts the U.S. draft response.
The Iranian foreign minister's visit to Moscow is of great significance, since Russia is a key player in the 2015 deal and shares Iran's stance in the accord. Now, while the United States' response to the EU draft proposal is still under examination in Tehran, here, Sergei Lavrov says Russia will accept nothing less than Tehran's full rights under the agreement. Yusuf Jalali, Moscow.
On the 30th of August last year, the last of the U.S. troops hastily left Kabul International Airport, marking the end of a two-decade occupation of Afghanistan. On its anniversary, the people of Afghanistan are celebrating this occasion. They say being independent and free from any occupation is a great blessing for the nation.
This is a victorious day for Afghans. 1 year ago, the U.S. occupying forces were forced to leave Afghanistan. Of course, they were defeated against the will of our people. We are proud that another invasion failed in our country.
Most Afghan people believe the U.S. invasion brought them nothing but more conflict, poverty, destruction, and suffering. They say today it is Afghans who are in charge of their own country and that they should work to build their homeland.
In the past 20 years, we didn't witness anything except bombardments, destruction, and civilian casualties. People across the country were busy burying their loved ones every day.
We have gathered here to mark Afghanistan's independence from the U.S. occupation. Last year, on this day, the U.S. withdrew from our country. We are happy that the U.S. is no more present here. But unfortunately, our country is reeling from economic problems.
I hope the new rules of Afghanistan provide job opportunities and protect the rights of all Afghans.
Participants also called on the U.S. to learn from its past mistakes and stop the ongoing ill policies towards Afghanistan and its people. 1 year on, Afghans are celebrating the U.S. withdrawal from their country. People here say they are happy that the U.S. invasion was ended because they were exhausted by Americans' gross violations. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
England's healthcare service workers receiving national praise for staying in the job through the grueling days of the pandemic to save lives. An increasing number of them, doctors, nurses, and midwives, have either quit the service or are actively considering to do so.
Profits have risen by 35% in the UK since the pandemic. More money to the rich, but not to those that are sick or for people that care for them.
The most recent culprit, poor pay. Rejecting a 4% pay increase in the face of soaring inflation, they're set to vote for industrial action.
Even with all those budgeting, we are still struggling. And so what would help in the NHS really was to increase our salary like everybody else is getting bonuses. We are not. Why? Why is this? And if you're not going to increase our salary, at least do something about transportation or even the parking. We can't be paying for things like this. It's ridiculous.
There are other reasons, too, for the exodus. A recent survey by union-led With NHS Staff campaign found stress, burnout, a feeling of abandonment after the pandemic. Some are having to use food banks or sleep inside hospitals. And it doesn't stop there.
There were other abuses of staff which made themselves clear, which also manifested. And actually, a large part of the nursing workforce who want to learn also cite discrimination. And there's a large amount of bullying, harassment, intimidation, discrimination that goes hand in hand with not every environment within the NHS, but within certain environments.
More people leaving the NHS means more work to be done by those who stay while they wait for the tens of thousands of vacancies across the country to be filled. A negative spiral hard to overcome in addition to the cost of living crisis. And then there's the years of underfunding and a wholesale drive to privatization, regardless of which party is in power.
The plan to privatize the NHS is not piecemeal. It's wholesale. I'm afraid Labour and Tory are like this. There isn't a fundamental difference in their attitude. We're already facing a winter bed crisis now. It's August, okay? And it's only going to get worse through the winter. So there is an under-provision in order to force people who can't get adequate care from the NHS into the private sector.
Created after World War II by a Labour government, the NHS is a publicly funded healthcare system, free at the point of need. Decades later, though, it's facing acute staff shortages, underfunding, and rapid privatization, which means that the crown jewel of Britain's public healthcare provision may soon be no more. Saipur is up, London.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you.
leaders' points of view in meeting with President Raisi and cabinet ministers. In the Islamic Republic of Iran, the week which commences on the anniversary of martyrdom of former President Mohammad Ali Rajai and former Prime Minister Mohammad Javad Bahonar, has been named as Government Week. Every year, the President and members of his cabinet meet with the leader of the Islamic Revolution during Government Week. In keeping with this tradition, this year, President Ebrahim Raisi and members of his cabinet, known as the 13th government, met with the leader of the Islamic Revolution at the Husseiniyah of Imam Khomeini, may his soul rest in peace, in central Tehran. Please stay with us for a summary of the leader's speech. At the start of the meeting, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, praised the two martyrs, Mohammad Ali Rajai and Mohammad Javad Bahonar, saying, "We honour the memory of these two martyrs. Undoubtedly, Mohammad Ali Rajai and Mohammad Javad Bahonar were two first-class managers of the highest calibre, worthy of the Islamic Revolution. We had known these two for many years, and we had worked with them for many years, particularly Martyr Bahonar, whom we knew very well. The Lord Most High granted them their reward in the form of martyrdom. It would have been a real pity if these two individuals had died without becoming a martyr. We pay homage to them and honour their memory." Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei went on to state the importance of remembering and recording the key events of the Islamic Revolution, as well as analysing the performance of the government during Government Week. He stressed, "Remembrance is the opposite of neglect. Remembrance is the opposite of oblivion. Neglecting and forgetting are great scourges. We must be aware of our current position. The skies over Tehran were once dominated by Saddam's air force, and we had no way of challenging them. The Baathist pilots boarded their fighter jets and flew over Tehran without any worries at all. There was nothing that we could do. They either bombarded Tehran or broke the sound barrier over our skies, and we couldn't stop them. That was the situation of our skies. Our land was very insecure. There was widespread insecurity throughout the country. Terrorists ran rampage in our streets, killing military and IRGC personnel, terrorizing shop owners, merchants, and ordinary citizens. We mustn't forget those days. That is now history, of course, and the Iranian nation and the Islamic Republic got through those difficult times with flying colors, emerging fully dignified and victorious." The leader added, "But the real wonder of those years was the incredible presence of the Iranian people on the scene, always offering their unfailing support. Whenever the government needed support of the people, they gathered in huge numbers and offered their full backing spontaneously, without even being asked to do so. This reality taught us valuable lessons, taught us how we should treat this honourable and great nation." A preliminary assessment of the performance of the 13th government during the past year shows us that this government has been planning for the long term, such as in relation with targeted government subsidies. Also, the government has strenuously tried in a jihadi manner to solve the problems faced by ordinary people. This effort becomes especially noteworthy when you consider that the enemies of the Islamic Republic have snapped the toughest of sanctions on Iran, and using satellite broadcasts and media campaigning have tried to spread dissatisfaction among the people. The leader went on to list a number of successes for the 13th government, headed by President Ebrahim Raisi. The leader said, "In my opinion, the biggest success that this government has achieved is revival of hope and trust in ordinary people. This is your most significant achievement." The performance of this government, including the performance of both President Raisi himself and members of his cabinet and senior officials, has conveyed to the people the message that this government is working hard to provide them with services and solve their problems. And this has revived the hope and trust of many people to a large extent. The leader went on to describe the 31 provincial trips of President Raisi to underdeveloped and disadvantaged regions of the country in the past 11 months as a shining page in the book of the government, emphasizing the speed with which the government has reacted to natural disasters, the speed being very praiseworthy and another positive point for the government. He added, "This shows the government cares about the people and is doing whatever it can to help." Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader said, "The main point of referring to these successes isn't just to lavish praise upon the government. Rather, I hope you continue with your good work and continue along your chosen path." Referring to the positive interaction within the three branches of the Iranian government, Ayatollah Khamenei praised the fact that the government was combating negativity and said, "This government has made a point of bringing in new faces, introducing relatively young people into the cabinet, and this is a very valuable and wonderful thing which should be encouraged." He added, "Bringing young people into the government is like a breath of fresh air. It's a very good thing. Introducing new faces in the old managerial structure is a great idea. We all know that young people sometimes make mistakes, and we have seen this both in the government and in the parliament, the Majlis. Nonetheless, this is worth it. Despite the mistakes, it is good to have young people, to have fresh faces in both the government and the Majlis. God willing, a new generation of competent and astute managers will emerge." Referring to the importance of making use of our own domestic resources and not relying on foreigners, the leader warned, "It is very detrimental to the country if we say our problems will only be solved if we have relations with such and such a country, or if we wait for others to act, or for other countries to act. Rather, we should rely on our own abilities and our own resources. We mustn't rely on foreigners. Waiting for other people to act is bad for the country." Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei praised the 13th government for accepting responsibility and working hard. He said, "This is a very positive point." The leader went on to give a positive assessment of the government's foreign policy and cultural activities and said it is a good thing that some of the main slogans of the Islamic Revolution have today become more prominent and more noticeable. Slogans such as demanding justice, support for the weak and downtrodden, combating the arrogant powers, and shunning extravagant and opulent lifestyle. Offering further advice to cabinet ministers, the leader said, "My first advice to you is that you should thank God for giving you the opportunity to serve the people, and you should make every effort in a jihadi manner to solve the problems faced by ordinary people. You must strive so that your communication with God must not be broken or cut off. Prayers and supplications are very important. Despite the volume and pressures of work, you must strengthen your communication with the Almighty. Thank the Almighty that you have been given the opportunity to serve the people, and strive hard to solve their every problem. Turning to agriculture, the leader said food security is extremely important. Referring to the Ukraine war and the problem of rising food prices and the problem of food insecurity, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei reminded the audience of the need to become self-sufficient agriculturally in production of essential food items, such as wheat and rice. He added, "Food security is very important. It should be given top priority and must never be neglected." In further remarks, the leader said, as far as industrial production is concerned, the banking sector has a duty of solving the problem of shortage of funds and shortage of investment in active manufacturing units. The Central Bank of Iran, the CBI, must ensure that all banks provide appropriate loans to manufacturing businesses and production units which need them. The leader also commented on construction of housing, construction of petrochemical refineries, the importance of transportation, both international and domestic, development of mines and minerals, and development of our maritime resources. In a further poignant remark, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "We must not allow the immense natural and human resources of this country to go to waste." He warned, "Work must not be left unfinished. Patience and resilience is needed to solve this country's problems. If you follow what I have said, then the 13th government will prove its worth. It will become known as an efficient, active government which is able to solve the problems faced by ordinary people. The Lord Most High will be satisfied, and so will the people, God willing, inshallah."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.